you're looking at. This is the circle that tends to dominate the risk management literature that I'm familiar with. This is the circle that contains all the numbers. So you have biologists with microscopes, astronomers with telescopes, all sorts of screening devices, surveys, statisticians, epidemiologists, data miners, all of this pursued with scientific rigor. But the third circle is where I would put most of the problems that have been discussed over the last 2 days. Cormac helpfully told us that we don't know how to measure security, we don't know how to measure usability, and we don't know how to measure the trade-offs. So that would assist me in putting most of the problems we've discussed in this circle. The scientists either just don't know, or reputable scientists disagree in ways that mystify the rest of us. Since I first produced this diagram, I've added the legal environment. What is my liability if something goes wrong? We've had the answer from Microsoft, no comment, earlier in the day. Certainly terrorism, and more generally, Mr. Rumsfeld's unknown unknowns. So, next framing device, moving quickly on. How do we manage risk? This is my favorite simple model of the essence. I call it the risk thermostat, and the thermostat gets set in the top left-hand corner. We all have some propensity to take risks. Life would be unutterably boring if we didn't. Risk-taking propensity leads to risk-taking behavior, which leads, by definition, to accidents. Taking a risk is doing something that carries with it a probability of an adverse outcome. Through surviving them, learning from them, seeing them on television, being warned by mother, we acquire our perception. And the model proposes that when propensity and perception get out of balance, there's behavior that seeks to restore it. And why do we take risks? There are rewards, and the magnitude of the reward appears to influence propensity. So you can see this in operation all over the place. When ABS brakes were first introduced, insurance companies offered discounts for what were clearly safer cars. Well, they don't anymore, because it turned out they weren't having fewer accidents, they were having different accidents. The potential safety benefit got consumed as a performance benefit, and they had high performance accidents instead. In the insurance world, this is known as moral hazard, that if you alter the perception of any particular risk, you automatically look for a shift in behavior. Well, we can use this diagram to now look at a couple of important biases. This, I would maintain, is what goes on in my head when I'm crossing the road. If I'm late for dinner, I'll take shorter gaps in the traffic to catch my bus. But once risk management becomes institutionalized, it tends to suffer from bottom loop bias. The institutional risk manager's job is to get accidents down, and then lower, and then lower still. This is the mantra of Britain's health and safety executive. As long as there's a single accident, your job is to reduce that risk still further. The converse, and this is what Frank Ferretti is always banging on about, the opportunity costs, the rewards foregone in the form of children's freedom, school trips, all sorts of things like that, if you suffer from this bottom loop bias. More recently, I've been pondering the problem of top loop bias. I used to call this the Macabre model. I now call it the Goldman Sachs model. The incentive structures that pay enormous rewards for taking risk-free risk with other people's money. And if you have an accident, you still get to keep your Christmas bonus. And so that has hugely distorted a lot of decisions that I think led up to the crunch. That suggests that we need to fit our thermostat with perceptual filters. Different people have different perceptions of the rewards and the risks associated with any particular problem, certainly in the realm of cybersecurity. And so I want to next move on to who is you, or who are we? And a simple little typology, starting here with this character called the egalitarian. And it occurred to me as Scott Cran was speaking, he doesn't seem to be here anymore, he was talking about sacred values. And each of the characters I'm going to introduce here, I think you can identify certain sacred values that they hold, and we can put it together with Bruce's metaphors and perhaps put them together and refer to them as sacred metaphors. They hugely influence the perception of any risk that you're trying to deal with. The egalitarian is somebody who is very strong on fairness and justice. He tends to be a bottom looper. You put environmentalists and consumer protectionists there. They're very concerned to protect the world and its inhabitants. If you can't prove it's safe, assume it's dangerous. Much more cheerful, this character, if you can't prove it's dangerous, assume it's safe. Here you find the venture capitalists, the entrepreneurs, the hedge fund managers, the racing drivers, and so on. They're much more fun to be with, actually. This is most of us most of the time, the poor benighted fatalist. His risk management strategy is to duck if you see something about to hit him and carry on buying lottery tickets. And this is where most of the risk managers are to be found. These are the custodes. I use this for a report for the health and safety executive in this country and pointed out to them that they were the statutory hierarchist and said for the foreseeable future you can guarantee you will be shot at from this quadrant, people saying you're not doing enough to protect us, and this quadrant, the entrepreneur is saying that you're over-regulating and suffocating enterprise. They have great difficulty communicating with each other. Well, I've used this on numerous occasions for quite different audiences. I've done it for some presentations for the Navy and the Ministry of Defense, and they said, oh, we know these people. They admitted that their organization was hierarchical, and up there they put Eisenhower and the general staff running the war efficiently. Down here they put the mavericks of military history, constantly at odds, risk takers, gamblers. I suppose now you could put General McChrystal down there as well. Here they put the ideologues from both ends of the spectrum. Everything from the suicide bombers to the ban the bombers. Ideologically driven, compelled by sacred values. And up here they put the poor bloody infantry. I tried it on a conference of psychiatrists. And they also thought they recognized these people to the extent that they started prescribing for them. this character, they decided, was paranoid. He got chlorpromazine. The individual they thought was manic, and he got lithium. The poor fatalist got Prozac. And then there was a pause, and I said, well, come on, that's you. You're the governors of Bedlam. What are you on? And after a pause, they admitted it was alcohol. Okay, rushing on. From a book that I highly recommend, The Database State, Ross and Company note that there are two different faces of government being joined up. One is the custodian of the public services, formalizes social compassion. The other is the enforcing or coercive state. It seeks to control and speaks of enemies, targets, suspects, and criminals. And the challenge is, government should, yes, act proportionately and as necessary, but how to find agreement about what is proportionate and necessary. So here you have the coercive custodes, and this relates to the database state because it's been discovered that the police are now compiling this vast database of extremists. And in The Guardian last Saturday, there was this article about this extremist artist who was on the database numerous times for going along to protest meetings, okay, and sketching them. So here, there are far more of these people. Up the top left-hand corner, those are the custodes. Down here, we have the those concerned with privacy and civil liberties. These are split. You have these people tend to be pro-libertarian, but also, so you would have the Tea Party and the National Rifle Association, the small state people, but also you have your security entrepreneurs down here. So they're a mixed bag. And up here is Dave from and it was Cartoon Dave. So the final slide, and how does the internet make things different? This circle has been hugely expanded. Security now involves attempting to impose order and restraint on billions of high-speed reflexive relationships between strangers. Thank you.
For me, and like I said,
not to mention one who uses a Mac and has a job with us on a semi-regular basis.
Yeah,
that's right. That's okay. Now you need that good.
Yes,
there you go. It's all about which time you get the thing.
Okay, so I kind of liked the setup of the previous talk. I believe I come to you today as a top-loop egalitarian, and maybe some of that will become a little bit more clear as I go through this. So, referring back to a couple of the other previous talks, I think what I'm going to talk about today is partly an effort to offer more models, echoing back to what Bruce was talking about, and to talk about trying to do a good job of answering Andrew Patrick's why question. So, framing this in terms of trying to fix the world, I think one of the things that I'm very, very conscious of in trying to fix the world at the moment, and again, referencing Bruce, the disclaimer that this is kind of biased toward the weird world as opposed to the world as a whole, is that we now live in an information age. We derive enormous value from the processing of information at a large scale and the possibilities of learning from that information. And we're grappling with the risks and the benefits of this. I think we have reasonable models in place for some of the risks and potentially some of the benefits, depending on what your perspective on it is. I think there's a reasonable model in place for surveillance, whether one sees that as a risk or as a benefit. I think there's a reasonable model in place for customization, whether one sees that as a risk or as a benefit. What I think is missing from the set of available models in reasoning about the risks and the benefits of this data is a model for what I would pull back on calling statistical machine learning from crowdsourced data. Now, I think I can say surveillance to a not very technical person, you know, to my mom. I think I can say customization to my mom. But the problem of how to make it so that my mom can do risk-benefit analysis about statistical machine learning applied to crowdsourced information, that one needs a little bit more work. And as I have worked on that problem, I found that it has really, really felt like, you know, surprisingly like, in many ways, the problem of trying to figure out how to make key management manageable by ordinary people. Because a lot of the same kinds of questions come up. And some of them are questions about what kind of technical literacy we should really be aiming for. I think I always have a little Angela in my head saying, "You're trying to make everyone into an engineer. Stop it." It's there always as a corrective. But at the same time, there's probably a certain level of understanding, a model, that you need to have in order to get past, we assert this to be true, trust us. It feels to me like we assert this to be true, trust us is just, you know, is not acceptable for some things. It's not acceptable for a situation in which everyone feels such a very personal and vulnerable stake in all of this data. So how do we get past that? How do we accept the responsibility to explain our rocket science? And so what I want to do is give you sort of the meta talk for a talk that I have learned how to give by giving it over and over for the past 2 years as the exercise of explaining the use of log data. Okay, and I'm not going to try to demo it for you exactly because I think I personally cannot handle the social context mismatch of explaining it to my mom, like to you guys, so I'm going to be kind of meta about it. And okay, a little bit more history on this. 2 years ago, about, is when we first started making a real effort to try to explain the use of the log data. And we had some really, in hindsight, entertaining conversations internally after that, in which communications and policy people said, "Come on, you guys still haven't really fessed up and explained. Stop being so secretive. You've got to cough up the answer." And engineers and research scientists said, "But we did explain." And that was sort of an eye-opening moment in terms of just how badly that explanation had devolved, had failed, and was simply, "We assert this to be true, trust me." So in trying to come up with the usable explanation, two things have been really important. So I would categorize, actually I'm going to page back because this is going to distract you for a moment. Before I jump into the slides, two things have been really important. One has been what I would call make it hello world, right? Base it on the absolute, completely simplest sort of hello world programming exercise of what it would be like to do what we do with the log data and walk people through that. And the second thing has been to embed it in a story. Those have been the two things that have made it really critical to get across the model. And going back to, Bruce, what you were saying about models and metaphors, part of what it, I think we, or I have had to grapple with, is recognizing that we couldn't find a good metaphor. So have to push past the metaphor and somehow be able to hold people's attention long enough to convey a model that gets past "we assert, trust me," and gets that click moment of people feeling like, okay, I see how that is. So the story and the hello world. Okay. So what we start off with on this, first of all, is by grounding it in giving them, when we're talking about the log data, this is what we're talking about, right? Giving a illustrative example that makes it concrete, because we're giving this explanation to people who do not actually know, who start out not knowing the difference between Google and the internet. So what it is that they imagine, it could be anything. So nail it down to begin with. It's something quick about, you know, this is what we're talking about with the log, walk through what the fields are, this is what we're talking about with the cookie to demystify. Then we hit the story, all right? And I think to some extent this story is what happens when somebody who came out of security really takes on the challenge of trying to come up with a good and accessible model about the log data, for understanding the use of the log data. And we wind up with this good guys, bad guys scenario, which we set it up to say, this is about, very importantly, learning from the good guys, and what that means, real quick, what that means is learning from the people who use the system in good faith, while fighting off the bad guys, and what that generally means is managing not to learn from the bad guy, from the people who use the system not in good faith, and then also some things for the more far out there uses of the log data that like flu trends. Providing some of the background history, giving an example of how that works for spelling check. But the basic core of it is to set up and say, here's what happens when someone searches on flowers. You get this initial log line that shows that they searched on that. That person then chooses a result to click on. The result that they click on creates another log line later in the log file and is a signal that Google systems can learn from, or any search engine systems can learn from, about what an actual human thought was the best search result. And that this boils down to that very little hello world example of a two log line pattern that systems can be built to learn from. And it needs to provide the model that isn't about customization, right? This is not about learning to give me a different search result next time. This is about learning from what I clicked on to give you a different search result next time. And to give people that click moment where if we walk them through it well enough, they anticipate what happens from seeing that second log line is the kernel of this. Now, I would say sort of where this is in this process is, it's progress to have started with learning how to tell the story at all. But I think where we are right now with it is that I can talk to people for 10 minutes with eye contact and you know, dramatic gestures and things like that and hold their attention and get them to get it. So the challenge then is, how do we translate this into part of the privacy policy? Or even better, what I would love the most is, how do we build services that demonstrate it intuitively? So I feel like that's sort of the open question. And I think this is, you know, looping back to the saving the world part, this is an important part of it, because if the only models that people have are customization and surveillance, then it's easy for the public discussion, the societal consensus, to think, well, if we all agree that we don't want customization and surveillance, then we can continue to have all of the services that we like in a privacy utopia. And I don't actually believe that to be true. And banging my head against this for a long time, I've pretty much pessimistically come to the belief that there's hardly any data that is interesting or useful that is also risk-free. So we'll stop there.
Last up,
well, thanks.
Summarize as he talks.
Well, I'm going to cheat slightly because been too busy organizing things to write a completely new top. So what I've done instead is to cut down and adapt a talk that I gave at the Protocols Workshop on some ideas that I've been kicking around with Frank. Let's see if the magic works. Yeah. Okay, so we've been figuring out what we can usefully do and learn as security engineers from interacting with economists and most recently with psychologists. Now, as we are beginning to have interest from anthropologists, I was beginning to think, what can we learn from anthropology? And the context for this was that we were thinking about virtualization. Let me start off with a bit of the geek stuff and then I'll get on to the psychology stuff later. Imagine by 2025 we've got a fully virtualized world, you've got virtualized services at the back end sitting in the cloud, you've got virtual clients in your laptop or in your VR headset or whatever we use then, so that you've got a context for doing banking, a context for doing play, a context for working in your defense contract, and so on. Now this can be quite complex technically, but how do you make this hang together with real people? Well, we spend an awful lot of effort as security engineers thinking about stuff like multi-level security and authentication protocols, but to a first approximation, all attacks are by insiders, and to a first approximation, they all start as errors. And an awful lot of what people do with fancy military systems is about trying to make it difficult for people to create really stupendous screw-ups as a result of errors. But commercial systems are error-prone, so how can you go about reducing the error rate? Well, how we do this in real life is that it's about things like context. We understand social context, we know whether you're in a lecture theatre or in a marble banking hall or on the beach, we know that there are different kinds of contexts that are appropriate. And this is one of the things that we're losing, I think, as everything goes online. Now, again, an idea that we bring from the technical space is that protocols often fail because the authentication is one way instead of two way. The banking terminal may be able to authenticate your card, but you can't authenticate whether the banking terminal is genuine. The mobile phone network can authenticate your phone, but you might actually be talking to a black box in the back of a police car instead. So let's bring this idea out and say that rather than just the laptop rather than just Alice wanting to identify which particular virtual machine she's talking to in her laptop, there's something else required as well. The laptop needs to know which Alice it's speaking to. So you might think, well, what's happened? Has Ross gone mad? Is this schizophrenia? Well, no, because as a practical matter, in the real world, there's a whole lot of different Alices. Now, even a few years ago, I used to essentially discard my work brain while I drove home, and I would reload my home brain in the 15 miles between here and there and be a different, much more relaxed person when I arrive. Of course, this is now being abolished by the internet because you've got this laptop sitting in the kitchen and you can do email, but let's worry about that later. So the laptop, in fact, wants to know whether it's talking to Alice.work, Alice's work brain, Alice.play, which is Alice out clubbing, Alice.bank, about to pay some money, or Alice.gov, working on a military contract. And so how can you, if you're a computer programmer, figure out what sort of mood the person that you're talking to is in? Well, Peter has shown some of the possible way forward, in that if you can teach a computer to recognize people's facial expressions, gestures, or tone of voice, then you may be some of the way there. And with this, you can start to deal with some of these problems that have been written about by George Loewenstein, Joe Sorin, and others, the hot-cold empathy gap, the things that can go wrong if you have got a system that assumes you're operating in a rational frame of mind and you operate it when you're in a state of being aroused or being tired or being angry or being drunk or whatever. Now, this is a particular problem as we move online with worlds like Facebook, where the world of continuous partial attention is replaced by one of continuous extreme distraction. Now, if you are constantly flitting backwards and forwards between affairs, gossips, games, and payments, then you surely expect people to start making mistakes. And of course, the bad guys will exploit this the bad guys will try to see to it that Alice.play gets to talk to machine.bank so they can get a password offer. Now, how do we actually solve this problem in the real world? Well, the fact is that we use all these non-verbal channels for empathic synchronization. You've got tone of voice, we've got facial expression, gait, all the rest of it. We've been discussing this. And an interesting thing that perhaps we haven't discussed very much so far is that many of these are interactive. We have ritual, we have manners, jargons. We chant things. You know, you have Latin graces at home. You've got dress codes. So people understand what they can expect, more or less, from someone who's dressed as a soldier, or as a surgeon, or as a bishop, or as a politician of the 1920s. But it's also significant that the clothes people on actually condition their behaviour. Companies in the city which have for years tried dress-down Fridays now tend to be moving away from it because they find that people do actually behave differently when they're wearing jeans and a t-shirt from when they're wearing a suit and a tie. How can we translate this into the world of systems? Well, there have been one or two hints at how we can reclaim the interaction. Matt Blaze's stuff on real-world protocols, unfortunately he couldn't be with us. He sprained his knee in Chicago and couldn't make the connecting flight. Carl Ellison talked about human-computer interactions as ceremonies. I talked earlier about the fact that when you do business with your broker, there may be a ritual over the telephone. I'm buying 2,000 shares from you at 131 pence. Yes, I agree. And then, of course, there's an idea Frank came up with a year or so ago. What hat are you wearing? You put an icon on the screen with, say, a baseball cap if you're Frank.play, and with a top hat if you're Frank.bank. Well, my suggestion is that if you're going to wear different hats in order to do access control, then what you should actually be doing is wearing a physical hat. You've got to get the physicality back into it somehow. And if the only way you could do banking was by picking up a top hat and putting it on your head, and then the little camera would come on your laptop and say, aha, he's wearing a top hat, we know that he's serious, we know that we'll let him into lloydstsb.bank.co.uk, then a number of the mistakes that people make wouldn't happen. So how might you instantiate this in the real world? Well, there are some environments where you could, in government departments, for example, where people wear access control badges and lanyards around their necks. Active audio feedback channels might work. Perhaps we can make audio interaction good enough that you can do the broker thing, I buy 2,000 shares from you at 131 pence, and actually talk to a program rather than talking to a human, but have it have the same kind of semantics and dependability and so on. So this is something that takes us out of the area of systems engineering as we classically understand it, and into an area of psychology and anthropology where we're not just trying to know the user's mood, but we're trying to see to it that we can put the user in the right mood, that you can impose some ceremony or performance on the user which brings the user up short. So if someone has just been watching porn or skiddling about on Facebook or whatever, and they're about to mortgage their house, then surely they should do some formal type things in order to break the train of thought and bring them to focus. Now, we have in our culture lots and lots of mechanisms that we already use in meet space for this purpose. We sing the national anthem, you know, or we recite a Latin mass before dinner in hall. And the point about such critical authentication processes is that they don't just require solemnity, but they induce it. And once you start seeing the world in these terms, the idea that you can have one dictionary password that you just put in 50 different places, that doesn't work. That actually performs no useful function in terms of ensuring that the user is in the right frame of mind. So these are the sort of conclusions that I would kick out as one of the things that we engineers might learn from interacting with psychologists and anthropologists, that we tend to see security as authentication protocols. But it's more than that. They're not just in the software, they're also in the brain. And if we're going to design decent mutual authentication protocols, it's not enough to just do usability testing, because, you know, for many applications, we'll be wanting to do interaction too. Now, from the point of view of people like Google and Microsoft and Yahoo, there's a big question here. Because if you start having lots of people sitting in call centers, even in India, even in Ghana, it costs serious money. So perhaps there's a big research question for computer scientists and for people who work at the effective end of computing. Is it feasible to automate an emotional interaction? Is it possible to manufacture some interaction between a person and a computer that has got an effect that's even remotely similar to attending a religious service or attending a graduation or your kid's prize giving or anything like that? Is there something that will actually push appropriate buttons and cause people to stop and think and pay attention, or in fact cause people to do anything that is reasonably dependable in some effective sense? Then there are broader questions. How do systems get embedded in culture? If you are going to bring in a ritual for doing certain types of things in the future socio-technical systems that we're all busy building at the moment, then how do you see to it that the rituals that you invent, the rituals that you can perform with appropriate software, actually work in some kind of cultural sense? Now, what in this sense does ritual mean? Can we actually design it? Or is it simply a matter of giving people the tools that they can go and evolve it for themselves? And I suppose what this really comes down to is replacing context. Because as we move to a world of continuous partial attention or continuous near total distraction, as context get taken away, there are going to be some places where we want that context to be put back, where we want context to be difficult to forge. My suggestion is how you can start putting that context back is by means of some ritual interaction, some ceremony, call it what you will, involving humans and software. If this is nuts, and you're perfectly welcome to say that it's nuts if you think it is, then what should we be doing instead?
But it still needs unpacking for people to get it.
was thinking about Ross's suggestion about incantations to put us in the right mental state. I'm not sure that's really how we approach banks or churches or even eating. It's just a sense of place rather than the incantation. So when I go into my bank building, it has to be quite a temple, but I think a sort of sense of frustration comes over me. I don't dress up specially, you know, but I know it's the bank. So perhaps the real answer is we should monitor people's location and posture when they're undertaking these activities. It happens, actually, true at home. When I am doing banking, I would probably go and sit in a slightly more upright chair, a table in front of me, whereas if I'm just surfing the web, I might be slouched somewhere. So perhaps that sort of monitoring would be effective.
Well, I suppose technically it would be easy to build a system which would allow you to do banking only if you took your laptop into the study.
Yeah.
And you forbid you to do it from the bedroom.
My question is for John. You presented this quadrant of people, hierarchists and the egalitarians and the individualists and the failures. So my question is this. With respect to managing risk, let's say, in my area, in your terrorism, would you say that we need to be, that if we want to help people manage, and you use this term, risk management, if we want to help people better manage risk, that terrorism, earthquakes, it could be cyber, and so forth, should we be communicating differently to each of these four groups? It seems to me they have different worldviews. And has probably think differently about risk information. Does that make some sense?
Well, absolutely, and that's why I don't know how to fix the world. these groups have, well, putting Scott and Bruce together, they do have sacred metaphors, and they're very difficult to share. If we keep talking about, you know, the public's risk perception, mm-hmm. we just put all that to one side and pretend it doesn't exist, but it does. And they all tend to have a different perceived relationship with the custodians at the top right-hand corner. how does President Obama communicate with the National Rifle Association and his more liberal supporters?
This helps me answer a question that I'm often asked during presentations. How come the people, you know, in some regions of the country where you think they are more risk for terrorism seem to be less concerned? And some areas of the country, like Wyoming, where you wouldn't think terrorists would even know where it is, seem to be very concerned that this is a big change kind of example, right? I think this speaks to this, quite frankly. It's very interesting.
But I think also you have to look at how the media play to each of these constituencies. One slide I flipped over was the Sun newspaper. An article where they were supporting, in this country, there's been controversy over whether it's right to hold, it should be possible to hold suspect terrorists for 42 days without trial. And the civil libertarians say no.
And the hierarchists probably were on board with that, right?
Hierarchists were quite happy with that. But the I was going to introduce The Sun as the fatalist newspaper. Because it's the most widely read tabloid in the country. If it leads. And so The Sun was very supportive of 42 days. And with more readers than any other paper in the country. The Guardian, my example from The Guardian, you know, they're very hostile. So you have these... Each of the sacred metaphors have their own meaning, which reinforce the metaphor, and makes the world very difficult to fix.
Actually, was small comment on Ross. I think Ross's suggestions about ways in which sessions could be demarcated by some kind of informal way in which the computer itself could bring you into the right mood is a really interesting one. And there would be some very simple things you could do. It could, for example, you could only access the bank when you had a big banner saying Professor Ross Anderson at the top of the screen. If you were doing something else, you could say Dad. You could also have a picture of you, which could have been rather carefully designed, so that this would be the appropriate reflection of who you are in this persona who's interacting with the computer in this way. I'm thinking of this partly because I know quite a lot about multiple personality disorder and the way in which alter egos have ways of getting themselves into the mood. They have nicknames, for example, which are appropriate to the sexy character, the responsible character, etc., etc. And there's a lot of feedback going on there, so that the alternative alters maintain their role by the kind of ways they present themselves to themselves. Now, computers can very easily reflect or invent, apparently it's the reflection you're seeing of yourself on the screen, and it would need some research, but I think we could very quickly shift people's sense of themselves by making it, as they interact with the screen, they have to be aware of who they are in this world.
Well, what we actually did in the work that Ross has mentioned a few years ago on multiple hats for the same user, was that when you switch to a different hat, your background of your screen would change. So you could have one that's more calm, it's green, and one where you do dangerous things, it's red, or something like that.
Yeah, but you could make it even more exclusive.
But we thought just a change of color is more visceral than just the name at the top of the screen.
I don't think so. I think it's like the name could actually be all photograph or something.
Did you want to respond to that?
I think it's a fascinating idea.
But no.
I think it's worth trying. If you get everybody to supply 4 or 5 pictures of themselves in appropriate persona, with collar and tie, with the kids on the beach or whatever, then I think that would have a strong inhibitory effect on certain kinds of behavior. Interesting experiment to do, if any of these.
I like the hat.
Yeah, I like the hat too.
And I really like the idea, but I think we should note that you're talking about the antithesis of usable security. I mean, what you're trying to make is non-usable security.
I'll let Alan respond.
I like the hat too. I wanted to add that maybe that was a Microsoft ISO, but it was my impression that a bunch of years ago, it might even be like 10 years ago, MSR did research on not so much the which you is it, but having different desktops basically that you would swap amongst for different levels of security. But I never heard sort of what the results of user testing were for that.
It wasn't good.
I would say that Butler Williamson has said that study will be done in the next year or for the last 10 years. It's an idea they keep plugging, but they've never tested as far as I
know. There was a test.
There was a test?
Yeah.
Oh, please.
Well, I think it's like intelligent brief. It's not good what's in there. There was a bunch of stuff done on military compartmentalized systems like this, and it was shown that people successfully used it for a brief period of time and then started deliberate, then their lives became intertwined to the extent that it didn't work anymore. They ended up buying people multiple computers, and that didn't work either.
Okay,
let's
go back. So I actually work in emotional interaction with robots and artificial agents and so on, and one thing that we find in the field is that it's very easy to induce emotion and get people to do stuff. But the problem is it's very difficult to sustain, because what happens is people tend to habituate. The novelty wears off. And it's hard to autonomously generate novelty to keep people engaged, to keep them doing the thing that you want them to do. So just sort of a comment on the things that Ross was talking about.
Okay.
I'm thinking about another dimension of this, which is classical conditioning. I had a roommate in graduate student who was doing experimental psychology. It was at Harvard at the time of Peter Skinner. He was a very prolific writer. And my roommate once asked him how he was so effective as a writer. He said, well, I have 2 desks. And I only use 1 desk for writing and nothing. because he believed in classical conditioning and conditioning himself. And he said, after having done this, Vermont could not sit at that desk without writing. So so the idea of actually having different colors on the screen and different experience, even if it needs to be somewhat immersive, the wall needs to be red. It's not just some of the light color, but the opposite of habituation, or the upside of habituation and loss of novelty, is in fact a very primitive form of classical conditioning in which, you know, if the right color on the screen, you might just feel this irrepressible urge to go to your banker's bank. So,
come here. I had a question for Alma. So this idea of telling a simplified story for privacy, I don't want to get into the actual debate about the content and if the story was true or accurate or not, but you can probably recognize that there's points that people would quibble with about if you say something's not identifiable on an IP address, that's a debate that's been had in the past. I guess my question is, well, what process should there be for reducing information to a simpler story to see that the story is accurate?
I think it really important part of it is the story be told really openly. So if you think the story is not accurate, you should be able to be out there saying so.
Okay, Richard. I guess this is kind of for all. I'm wondering if Google Insights does that sort of bad and all the stuff like it, does that help or does that only work for the people who already understand?
It should help. That's one of my personal hobby horses is to help
people be able to play with it so they can see what you can learn from it.
To get a position, because it's the people who would benefit from playing with it in that way. First of all, most people don't know that Google Insights exists. I mean, I come from journalists, and I know that Google Insights exists, and be excited because it's actually really cool for journalists to play with. But mostly it's only, you know, the people who are trying to figure out what would be good ad keywords that know it exists. So, yes, I hope that that would be part of what we can reposition as things for people to play with that give them more of an understanding.
Yeah. This is really at Nick and Ross's end of the table. And we've been talking about essentially task switching or star switching. And Nick, I think it was, said that it was not previously impossible to switch suddenly from being in your bank to being in a brothel. And Ross is sort of talking about rituals to get us to make that transition better. But while that's true about our physicality and our actions, it's never been true of our thoughts. And actually, part of what this is about, it seems to me, is something that a lot of people have always feared about computers, or at least advancing technology and perhaps neuroscience, that our thoughts would become transparent. And one thing that happens with computers is that the translation of thought into action actually becomes much easier because the action is done through the virtualized interface and so on. So I don't just have to think about, if I think about making what's actually a rather stupid purchase or taking up that enchanting offer from that nice man in Nigeria, I don't actually have to go out and go for a walk and do it. It can just translate immediately. So it's not so much the switching that's the problem. It seems to me that's the problem, but the move from thought to action that we previously has been controlled situationally. Perhaps I spend more time in church than you do, but let me tell you, not all thoughts in church are religious. Any more than all thoughts in a conference are academic. Or all thoughts in a bank financial. Well, I'll leave it there.
Do you want to react, or you want to?
He does his banking in Bravo, so does he.
You know this.
Well, I've been saying rude things about bankers for long enough that I might believe almost anything. But I do believe that many people do still have some kinds of mechanisms that would restrain them from doing certain things in certain places. I mean, it's all right on the beach to take your clothes off and run around and jump in waves and stuff. One doesn't do it while making an academic presentation.
Unless you're brindling, yes.
That's the fun.
Just a quick comment. So in the U.S., T-Mobile has a phone, or that phone called the MyTouch Slide, that just released that enables contact switching as a feature, and so that the major marketing point is the shift between work and play based upon predetermined times and GPS location. So you can, when you're near work, you can have your work email all pop up, and when you go home, it'll go to your personal email and your photo stream. That's another context where it's being tried, and maybe it's more successful in phone context that takes a computer desktop.
So just a small comment, it's just a matter of time before people start attacking context and trying to pretend, to try and hack your machine so that it looks like it's a bank when in fact it's a leech, or it looks like it's a leech when you're in fact a bank. So you do open up a whole range of possible things you can be spindling it.
I just want to comment on, and Ross mentioned the actual real effects of wearing different clothing. There was a fascinating study that appeared in Psychological Science last month, in which women were given designer sunglasses, and half the group were told that these were fake designer sunglasses. The women wearing fake designer sunglasses behaved in much more dishonest fashions on a whole series of tests of cheating on exams and would be prepared to mislead their friends about information and so on. Entirely as a result of that self-perception induced by the fact that they had been, hadn't even chosen, they'd been given these fake designer sunglasses to wear. So humans are very complicated creatures, but just because of that, it means there are lots of possible ways in which we could take advantage of the age-old ways in which we respond to situational variables like this.
Well, the other problem is that there are very strong economic incentives to remove situational bounds that were previously useful. Your banker would love to have you bank in a brothel. Because the more places you make transactions, if they're making the 2.5%, the more money they make. Similarly, one of the reasons that the internet was supposed to make us all rich was the abolition of transaction costs generally. But perhaps what we're saying is that the abolition of transaction costs has gone too far. But then again, an economist might dispute that.
Other questions?
So, one situation where you see an attempt to put users in different contexts is that some websites will make you type your name to essentially sign a statement. And because signing something means, right, has an emotional meaning, it has a context of doing something serious. And we've designed systems where we've actually had people not only had to sign, but sign to a statement saying, I do solemnly swear, that puts them in a court context. And this seems to be an existing example of somewhere where this is already done to try to get people, right, this is a more serious situation you need to be thinking before you type your name.
I wonder whether that could habituate. I mean, most people are in a court context often enough to habituate, but maybe people who always are.
Yes, don't spread the word.
Reasonable lawyers,
I don't know. So, if I was Cinderella, I'm not sure whether I'm going to the ball, but the UK is conducting another, as the US does endlessly, review of cybersecurity, which Ross is involved, so he doesn't have to say, but the other three are each. What would be the one soundbite you would like to take, or you'd like Ross to take, to that review for the UK in terms of what we should be doing about security and human behaviour? Because right now, security and human behaviour isn't high on the agenda of that review. So what would you suggest? What would each of you think?
I'm not sure I have a positive suggestion. I find this discussion terribly depressing. Over coffee, we had a discussion about blind justice. And when did this concept come in? You frequently read reports of trials in which after the jury renders a verdict, then the prior and it's all revealed. And gosh, he had all the other things that he'd done that only they had known. But you're not allowed to know that anymore. Now, it has to be a relatively recent phenomenon. Because in a small-scale pedestrian society, everybody knows everybody. Everybody knows everybody else's prior. But we've now, and hugely accelerated by the internet, it was accelerating physically, but now we have electronic mobility, and we live amidst strangers. We've lost the social capital that comes with knowing people. If you live in a small society, you trust people, or you know why you don't. And we're trying to invent substitutes for this, and I haven't heard any convincing ones yet.
I guess on that one, there's such good evidence that it's really leads to greater justice if people are not being trained. People simply cannot discount things that they know about.
And
this came up in the evidence this morning about how bad information sticks, mud sticks, and so someone's changed their ways, people aren't able to figure them out. And so I think it's just as well as not allowed. I've got soundbite for Ross. I think it was revealed. Yes, you should take that cartoon with Dave along with him. Basically, that the systems are designed by engineers, but they used by complicated and vulnerable and emotional end users. And if they don't make the right decisions, then the technology can be as good as it can be.
I have two soundbites that back on when I get dragged into periphery of these things. One is that we all just need to keep asking over and over again, are we talking about people dying or are we talking about people not being able to read their email?
Right.
And then the second thing is that one of the things that I think is actually great about the internet in terms of these particular problems is that so much can be solved by neutralizing rather than by catching. Right? By simply fending off the denial of service attack, by identifying the bad clicks and not charging for them, by doing all of these things. And why I think that's great is because if you accidentally put the wrong click in the bad click bin, you haven't really hurt anyone. Right? But when you accidentally catch someone because you think they were a bad guy and they weren't, well then you've gone a long way toward hurting someone. So I hope that in this space, we'll leverage as much as possible trying to find the mitigations that don't require going out and catching somebody. And instead, just simply, you know, make the internet strong enough, make the services strong enough that the attacks don't happen.
Okay, we'll stop there. Other questions can wait for dinner this evening. If you could thank the panelists, if you could thank all the organizers.
Particular about that. About a year ago, Ross came to me and some other friends and said he was going to be organizing this conference and he wanted some people around him to help him do it. And I witnessed over this last year how Ross himself has single-handedly created this whole event with very little input. I think I can speak to his other so-called assistants and colleagues as a lot of the organization committee. Ross did it, and we sat down amazed to see this remarkable meeting developing. That's not true for his graduate students and others who I know have been actually very very much involved in.
We were lots of the guys in the team who have been shepherding people around and arranging staff and putting out power cards and doing the other 101 things behind the scenes that you don't see, so they're also due away now. So I suppose, well, it isn't time for the final word, because I presume we're seeing all of you at dinner at 7 o'clock at Robinson College. And I suppose I should reiterate, as we said at dinner last night, that Alessandra's agreed to organise Security and Human Behaviour 2011 in Carnegie Mellon.